Hello, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Mario Cajar, and today I'll be reading from the March 2024 issue of Sports Illustrated and the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. First up, we have an article by Emma Bacciolieri, and it's titled, L.A. Story. Cheryl Miller did something last summer that she had never done before. She bought USC women's basketball season tickets. Miller, of course, is the best player in the history of the program, if not the history of the game. She led the Trojans to glory in the 1980s and served as head coach in the 90s. Yet she couldn't remember when she last caught a USC game before this season. It had been at least 10 years, she figured, maybe 15. She hadn't bothered even for the crosstown rivalry games with UCLA. The program no longer engaged a whole lot with its alumni, says Miller. But they hadn't missed too much. The Trojans had one of the most storied histories in the game. USC was among the first schools to give Division I basketball scholarships to women in the 70s and won two of the first three NCAA women's championships with Miller in the 80s. The biggest stars in the sport had been the women of Troy. Yet that legacy had more recently given way to an extended, desultory period of frustration. Forget contending for championships. It had been more than a decade and a half without so much as an NCAA tournament win for the Trojans. But that environment began to shift over the last few years. When USC hired former Cal head coach Lindsey Gottlieb to lead the program in 2021, she extended an open invitation to former players, welcoming them back to campus. Come to practice anytime. Talk to the team. Help connect them to the program history. Miller was happy to do that. As this season drew nearer, however, she realized that she wanted more. Miller was going to come back to Trojans games, she decided. Not just occasionally, but as often as possible, as close as she could get. For the first time in her life, Miller bought USC season tickets, picking out four courtside seats, and she prepared to bear witness. She needed to be front and center for this. Cheryl Miller wanted to watch Juju Watkins. The 6'2" freshman guard had been the top recruit in the country, boasting a rare combination of skill, size, and speed. Judea Watkins had been recruited by all the best college programs in the country, but she turned her focus elsewhere. The Los Angeles native decided she didn't want to join a perennial contender. Instead, she wanted to restore a legacy to her hometown. Watkins became the first Gatorade National Girls Basketball Player of the Year to choose USC since Lisa Leslie in 1990. And Watkins began delivering on the hype immediately. Watkins scored 32 points in her college debut. That it was a statement win over number 7 Ohio State made it all the better. This kind of performance from her soon felt routine. USC's record for 30-point games in a freshman season had been 3. Watkins passed that in November. That included a Thanksgiving tournament in the Bahamas, where late in the fourth quarter, the Trojans found themselves down by 6 against Penn State. No problem. Watkins quickly engineered a 7-point run. In a minute and a half, she had a pair of layups, 2 rebounds, and a transition 3 that felt straight out of the NBA, says Gottlieb. The game, which was held in a tiny gym, was not televised, and the contrast between context and performance felt staggering. Watkins had simply bent the score to her will. It was just the 5th game of her college career. This was part of the program's best start in a generation. After being largely absent from the rankings for years, USC climbed back into the top 20 and then into the top 10. By the end of December, the Trojans had reached number 5, their highest mark since Miller had been on the sideline coaching Leslie. Watkins had done in a few weeks something no one else had been able to do in her lifetime. She'd returned USC women's basketball to national relevance. Her teammates call it the Juju Effect. Sold-out gyms, autograph seekers and picture takers, an entirely different environment from just 1 year ago. It seemed as if there had been no hesitation, no recalibration, no adjustment period at all, really. There was only before Juju and after. Miller was taking it all in from her courtside seat. Beyond her historic playing career, she coached in both college and the WNBA, in addition to spending years as a broadcast analyst. What comparison does she have for a freshman this dominant a two-way player so early in her career? Miller takes a moment running through a mental catalog of luminaries and finds just one. Another daughter of California who drew astonished crowds at USC. There's only one other person who really stands out, Miller says, finally, and that would be me. Ted Watkins Memorial Park lies 7 miles from USC's campus. In the south-central L.A. neighborhood of Watts, it has a playground and a soccer field, picnic tables and walking paths, a swimming pool, and a gym with a basketball court. This is home for Watkins. That's true in a literal sense. She grew up about 5 minutes away playing on that court all the time, as she puts it, friendly enough with the man who ran the gym that he would open it just for her. But it's home in a more personal, essential way as well. Her family has been here for generations. The park is named for her great-grandfather. A civil rights activist, Ted Watkins founded the Watts Labor Community Action Committee, which aims to ease poverty and improve quality of life in the neighborhood. He spent decades working to provide affordable housing, jobs, and health care in an area where those were often scarce. Ted died before Juju was born, but his legacy has always felt very near to her. There is his nonprofit, still a presence in Watts, and now run by her grandfather, Tim. She'd see Ted's name, her name, every time she went to shoot hoops. In 2020, when a 15-year-old Watkins was named SI Kids Sports Kid of the Year, this was her chosen location for the photo shoot. Ted Watkins' motto was, "Don't move, improve." The park is a testament to that, a place intended to make the neighborhood more beautiful, more clearly a community. That principle resonated with his great-granddaughter. It was much bigger than basketball, but it framed her college choice in a way that felt just right to her. "If I stayed home," says Watkins, "I'd have the chance to build something bigger that meant more than if I went anywhere else. Don't move. Improve." Gottlieb picked up on this attitude in her earliest conversations with Watkins. There are some players whose motivations can seem inscrutable, even to themselves, an impossible tangle of desire and impulse. Watkins was the opposite. Gottlieb could identify her driving force right away. 100% it was her connection to family and community, says Gottlieb. That was really evident. But at the same time, I knew I couldn't just assume that it meant, oh, she'll stay home. I had to build that trust with her. There was no shortcut for that. Gottlieb, who came to the Trojans after 2 years as an assistant with the Cleveland Cavaliers, had only just begun laying the groundwork for what she wanted to accomplish at USC. She'd brought in some transfers, and she'd started connecting with alumni, trying to make the history of the program feel more present. But this was then still a losing team. Gottlieb couldn't show Watkins exactly where she would fit on the roster or how that would look. She couldn't invite her to a game and be confident that she would see a packed gym. All that Gottlieb could do was describe her vision and hope that Watkins might want to build it with her. "That's where I credit her so much for the courage," says Gottlieb. "She had to believe in something she wasn't seeing." Watkins bought it. She liked Gottlieb. She found that she trusted her implicitly. When she made her official campus visit, she felt immediately at home in a way she hadn't expected, fully able to imagine a future there. She enjoyed meeting with the university president as much as she enjoyed meeting with the equipment manager. Watkins especially liked the answers she got from Gottlieb to specific basketball questions. A free-flowing offense was a key for her. "I knew she had to be coached in a way that allowed her to be the artist she is," says Gottlieb. It was unorthodox for a number one recruit to choose a school that hadn't made the Sweet 16 in almost 3 decades. But this was it for Watkins. She made the boldest choice available to her. Watkins decided to stay home. She wanted to build something. It shows her maturity and how confident and poised she is, says USC graduate student and team captain India Otto. I think that decision validates what she's about and who she is. Gottlieb had logged so many hours recruiting Watkins that she didn't believe anything could surprise her by the end of the process. I don't think anyone saw her play more in high school than me, she laughs. I went every time it was legal to go. Gottlieb felt very familiar with both Watkins' depth of character and her talent on the court. She knew she was recruiting a thoughtful player with a modern do-it-all skill set. Yet the coach still found herself awestruck when the teenager called to say her choice was USC. Gottlieb realized Watkins might be even more exceptional than she'd thought. It illustrates that she's one of those special ones, says Gottlieb. There's this belief, a belief in herself and a belief in what hasn't happened yet, and I think you have to be wired differently for that. That decision-making process gave us some insight. Teammates and coaches rave about Watkins' jump shot and her work ethic and her ability to adjust in real time, but they especially marvel at her sense of control. This is meant both mentally and physically. Watkins is always calm on the court, appropriately intense without being excitable, and she operates with a tremendous economy of motion. Her body control is phenomenal. No one draws a foul like Watkins. Just that ability to shift in the air, to draw contact, to finish through, says Gottlieb. It makes her unique. There are no accidents in her game. To watch her is to see a player who makes everything seem deliberate. It's hard to imagine that Watkins could have developed any other way. She was first labeled a potential generational talent as a preteen. That opened incredible doors, but it created intense pressure as well. Watkins attended top private schools. She played first at Windward, where she was coached by former WNBA player Vanessa Nygaard, and then at Sierra Canyon, where she was in the same class as Bronny James. As a teen, she began training with Los Angeles Lakers assistant coach Phil Handy, and she was soon in workouts alongside pro players. She signed with Nike before she committed to a college. By the way, Watkins was the first high school girls basketball player Nike signed to a name, image, and likeness deal. The brand filmed a commercial featuring her playing pickup in her prom dress. But her family was conscious of allowing her to experience these opportunities without letting them swallow her life. They've been very intentional about both allowing her to be a kid and treating her a little differently in terms of her ability, Gottlieb says. They've been very smart about understanding her value and what her brand is and what's important to her. I think there's been a lot of forethought and vision to first and foremost allow her to impact her community and be a happy human. Watkins' world has grown much bigger, but she has kept her circle deliberately small. All of my decisions kind of reflect the person I am and what I'm striving to achieve, says Watkins. It's just making sure that the right intent is always there. The program's flashiest player in decades is remarkably low-key. She always thinks big picture, says Otto. She just leads her life with such humility. For all the attention and accolades she has, you won't find many people as humble. And she's now exactly where she wants to be. The front runner for National Freshman of the Year, she has scored more in women's college basketball this year than anyone not named Caitlin Clark. And even with her historically hot debut, she has found ways to keep improving. Watkins is a threat from anywhere on the floor, able to score from three, at mid-range, and in the paint. She's both a facilitator on offense and a nightmare on defense. In addition to leading USC in scoring, by the way, Watkins is the team leader in assists and steals per game. She's pushed her teammates to improve, too. She really does make people around her better, says Otto. Her energy and presence and spirit are just so special. For a player like Otto in her fifth year at USC, the change feels almost unbelievable. That the Trojans are winning this much is difference enough, but the way that people are responding, attendance has tripled year over year, is astounding. They've grown accustomed to throngs of fans waiting for the team bus. That's the kind of stuff I saw when I was in the NBA, says Gottlieb. She thinks back to how she described those crowds as hypotheticals for Watkins during recruiting. There weren't 10,000 people in the gym then, says Gottlieb. There weren't people lined up around a block. I couldn't look at our games and say, this is going to be your crowd. I had to really try to tell her that her gravity would make Southern California show up. Well, it has. USC has played host to a slew of celebrities this season. Every game features a gaggle of Watkins' friends and family, including her parents, Robert and Sari, and her three siblings. And, of course, Miller, sitting courtside, watching a player who is both very much like her and unlike anyone else in the world. Every outing has provided one thrill or another, but the game that stands out the most is the biggest one to date. A USC matchup with UCLA always means something, but this one meant the most in decades. UCLA gave USC its first loss of the season on the road in December. So in the rematch at home a couple of weeks later, USC had not just rivalry on the mind, but also revenge. You had all of us old-timers in the stands and courtside. The atmosphere was crazy, says Miller. It's a culture change. UCLA entered the building undefeated. It didn't leave that way. USC 73, UCLA 65. It was showtime, and the ladies, they showed out, says Miller. No one showed out like Watkins. She scored 32, including a perfect 16 of 16 at the free-throw line with 10 rebounds. When the buzzer sounded, Watkins collapsed, grinning, felled by leg cramps, but triumphant as teammates swarmed. It was exactly what Watkins came to USC to do. It's what Miller bought tickets to watch. You're tuned in to the Magazine Rack on Chris. Now we have an article by Connor Orr titled, Saquon Barkley Was No Longer a Necessity for the Giants. Saquon Barkley agreeing to terms with the Philadelphia Eagles is not the most noteworthy move of the offseason, but it is probably the most poetically satisfying for the player. He was drafted in 2018 to maximize the tail end of Eli Manning's career, but instead got the tail end of Eli Manning's career. Barkley was then held up as a boy for Daniel Jones, but instead got Joe Judge and Jason Garrett as play callers, making that largely impossible. After finding some modicum of success under the first real play caller he'd worked with in Brian Daboll, Barkley wanted to be a franchise player with a contract commensurate with that kind of role. Instead, he got a modified franchise tag and a soft encouragement to start looking for life outside of East Rutherford, New Jersey. In going to the Eagles, Barkley did what we'd all imagine we'd do when a company, a loved one, or something else in our life seems like they're underappreciating us. We go work for, date, or sign with their most bitter rival. In theory, Barkley will have a better chance of success with the Eagles. Even without Jason Kelce, Philadelphia still boasts a strong offensive line and a stout, mobile quarterback who can open up vast running lanes. Barkley is the right player for an Eagles team attempting to rescue the remnants of a 2022 Super Bowl bid. Of course, we're all mostly wondering whether the New York Giants made a mistake. For those who follow the team's history closely, this feels like Justin Tuck going to the Raiders, or the Giants choosing Victor Cruz and allowing Hakeem Nicks to sign with the Indianapolis Colts. Really, only Tuck, who found a late career swoon in Oakland, was probably worth New York chasing financially. But we're arguing momentary satisfaction versus long-term reality, and the truth is the Giants could probably end up replicating whatever numbers Barkley puts up with the Eagles from this point onward with a combination of cheaper running backs and a deep free agent pool, plus the draft pick they will eventually get from the compensatory formula. Because Barkley plays in a larger market, there are questions about loyalty and extraneous values that don't always exist with other teams and in other cities. He was drafted number 2 during a complete void of other success and talent. His contributions stood out above and beyond, and thus he created a kind of personal gravity for himself. Indeed, some of the people who were probably clamoring for the Giants to trade Barkley over the past 2 years are probably bemoaning his exit today. To me, Barkley's value was its greatest when he could take on an exceptionally high volume of work and remove pressure from a quarterback. During his rookie season in 2018, he was targeted a staggering 121 times, acting as a kind of backfield mobility to compensate for the increasingly statuesque Manning. Barkley had 91 receptions that year, gaining more than 700 yards through the air in addition to 261 carries and more than 1,300 rushing yards. No matter how good a player, it's impossible to project a running back going into his age 27 season to have that kind of impact. It's also hard to project any numbers if the Giants are thinking of starting over at the quarterback position and are truly in need of an every-down back who will soak up a ton of behind-the-line catches and runs straight into the line of scrimmage. You also need to factor in Barkley's injury history after he's played only two complete seasons. We bring this up a lot, but the Giants desperately needed to cut ties with everything resembling the Dave Gettleman era. It's not that Gettleman did a lousy job. Rather, it's that he imagined a team that could be competitive in theory, but failed to adequately find the right people to coach it. Those coaching staffs eventually expired one after the other, while the right players either aged out, got injured, or became more sensible to trade. Making the playoffs in DeBoer's first season seriously impacted that process of weed removal. So, instead of hastening the ouster of these players in exchange for draft capital or valuable repetitions for younger players, it made them something of a momentary necessity, and Barkley defined that better than anyone. That necessity forced Barkley and the Giants to hold on to one another like castaways on an eroding island, but Barkley's rescue ship has now arrived. Solemnly wave if you wish, Giants fans, but in the long term, replacing him will be cheaper and more efficient. And that is the true definition of winning free agency, far above the emotional satisfaction. You're listening to the Magazine Rack on Chris. The next article is written by Stephanie Epstein, and it's titled, Shohei Ohtani, Yoshinobu Yamamoto Bring Enough Spotlight for Other Dodgers to Shine Overseas. When Los Angeles Dodgers superstar Shohei Ohtani announced his marriage last week, television stations in Japan broke into their programming to report the news. Newspapers distributed special editions. Women took the day off work to mourn the death of Ohtani's bachelorhood. James Outman isn't out looking for that kind of fame, but he thinks it might be fun to star in a commercial for a Japanese candy company. The market has grown, so understanding how to utilize that could be important for your brand, says the Dodgers center fielder. But I think the goal of being famous isn't really a good goal. Still, with the addition of Ohtani and right-hander Yoshinobu Yamamoto, himself a star, to the Los Angeles roster this year, has come an opportunity for their teammates. Dozens of Japanese reporters follow their every move, filming each moment of Dodgers spring training and breathlessly conveying updates to an adoring public. And some of those shots will be righty Michael Grove. I'm trying to get the background of one, he says. So far, no luck. We're on different schedules. But he is considering trying to learn a joke in Japanese while the cameras are on. I'll have no idea of what I said, he says, but I'll smile. Indeed, that's about all it took for utility man Tyler Wade in 2022, when he was Ohtani's teammate with the Los Angeles Angels. He showed up in a few photos and suddenly became a heartthrob. Ohtani began referring to him as Ikemen, which means hot guy. Who will be the Dodgers' hot guy? A dozen Dodgers weighed in, and a few common themes emerged. Some believed fans would fall in love with players' personalities. Some went straight for the looks, and a few thought performance might matter. Yamamoto, who ought to know, says reliever Brustad Graterol will be a hit. He's funny, Yamamoto says through interpreter Yoshihiro Sonoda. Reliever Joe Kelly has a shot after his wife, Ashley, publicly offered Ohtani Kelly's number 17 if he signed there, and after Ohtani thanked the couple by buying Ashley a Porsche. So does reliever Ryan Brossier, who spent 2017 pitching for the Hiroshima Carp. Outman's pick is left fielder Teoscar Hernandez. He gets along with Shohei so well, says Outman. They're always goofing around. He's teaching him Spanish. Shohei's teaching him Japanese. The stories write themselves. But photos tell a story, too. It's not a bad-looking room, says third baseman Max Muncy, but I don't think I'm at the top of that list. A few days later, posed the same question, utility man Kike Hernandez shakes his head. Definitely not Muncy, he says. Hernandez himself is manager Dave Roberts' pick. Kike's going to find his way next to Shohei quite often, he says. But Hernandez casts his eyes around the room and then beams when he reaches the locker of righty Tyler Glasnow. He's like a sex god, says Hernandez. Big, tall dude, long hair. Glasnow and Outman are the most popular answers. Both have celebrity doppelgangers. Even actor Cillian Murphy has commented on his resemblance to Glasnow, and both reliever Evan Phillips and shortstop Gavin Lux point out that Outman looks a bit like Kit Harington, who played Jon Snow in Game of Thrones, and has luscious locks. By the way, Lux insists he himself has no shot unless he grows out his own hair. It's way too short, he says. Outman is looking forward to that candy deal, and Glasnow says that sushi is one of his favorite foods, and he'd like to try to find a way to parlay that into something. An omakase-style thing, he says. I don't know how you endorse that. But his pick is second baseman Mookie Betts, who, until Ohtani signed, was the team's best player. Several Dodgers also suggest seven-time All-Star baseman Freddie Freeman, who shakes his head vigorously. Although he does admit his seven-year-old son Charlie, an avowed Ohtani fan, might have different goals. And it will happen whether he wants it to or not. Everybody pretty much gets some extra fame from being associated with Shohei and Yamamoto, says Phillips. That's going to do so much good for the Dodgers brand. Basically, if a player wants to take advantage of it and grow their brand in an international way, this is the time to do it. Betts is an image-conscious athlete. He has his own logo, a deal with Jordan Brand, and a marketing company. But he says he's not thinking too hard about his Q score abroad. Hopefully, after we win a World Series, he says, we're all going to be famous in Japan. You're tuned in to the Magazine Rack on Chris. Now here's an article by Bob Harrig titled, Tiger Woods declining to compete at Players Championship is a mystery. Tiger Woods skipping the Players Championship this week without any reason will understandably lead to all kinds of conjecture about his back, his leg, and all manner of possible maladies. But it's quite possible that Woods is simply being careful and doesn't want to overdo it with the Masters on the horizon. Now, that's not great either. It was Woods himself who back in December sounded confident enough that he said he could attempt to play once a month, starting with the Genesis Invitational. The Players' Championship on a flat Florida golf course with 3 weeks after the Genesis and 3 weeks before the Masters seemed a perfect spot. It's fair to wonder if there was more to Woods' withdrawal after 6 holes during the second round of the Genesis than the illness that was reported. There's little doubt that Woods was ill. His trips to the restroom in short order suggested that something wasn't right. But Woods himself mentioned a back spasm issue during the first round, and while it never seemed apparent, perhaps there was more there? And if it prevented him from working on his game to any degree, maybe that's why he doesn't feel ready to play this week. Woods competed a week ago in the Seminole Pro Member, a one-day outing in which he was paired with PGA of America CEO Seth Waugh. Brad Faxon, The NBC analyst was there and reported that Woods looked good. All of which makes this week's no-show a mystery. Woods could enter the Valspar Championship next week, but that doesn't seem likely. So now he tries to prepare for Augusta National and the 5-year anniversary of his Masters victory, the 15th major title of his career. It's an awful lot to ask him to be competitive after just 24 holes of official golf this year, but that's what Woods now faces. And a few more things. Mateo Manassero was just 16 years old when he was grouped with Tom Watson during the first two rounds of the British Open at Turnberry in 2009. The same Open where Watson nearly pulled off a miracle before losing in a playoff to Stuart Sink. Manassero was just weeks removed from winning the British Amateur. He ended up tied for 13th at that Open, and a year later became the youngest winner on the DP World Tour at age 17. But times have been tough for the Italian golfer, who went 11 years without winning before his victory on Sunday at the Janssen Workman Open in South Africa. Now 30, Manassero called it, and I quote, "the best day of my life on a golf course for sure," end quote. Will Zalatoris, who tied for fourth at the Arnold Palmer Invitational, earned the lone exemption being offered into the Open at Troon. The Open qualifying series event was for the top player in the field who made the cut and was not previously exempt. Zalatoris, who was ranked 34th in the OWGR coming into the week, was likely to qualify via the top 50 cutoff in May. The next event in the opening qualifying series is the Mizuno Open in Japan, May the 23rd through the 26th. Scotty Scheffler, who won the Arnold Palmer Invitational, will attempt to become the first player to defend the Players' Championship title, which is in its 50th year. Scheffler will be the first defending champion to enter the Players at number one in the world since Rory McIlroy in 2020, when the event was canceled. The first round of the Masters is in 31 days. And that'll do it for this week's installment of the Magazine Rack on Chris. I've been reading from the March 2024 issue of Sports Illustrated and from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. I'm Mario Cajar. So long till next time.